Iowa is well known around the globe for agriculture.
We ship over $1.5 billion worth of pork out of the state of Iowa overseas every year. We produce more corn than all but three countries in the world.
And its current Secretary of Agriculture, Bill Northey, is about to take those talking points to the political soundbite capital, Washington, D.C. Hello, I'm Paul Yeager. This is MTOM, a behind-the-scenes look at the show and the newsmakers you see on the program. Shortly after our conversation was scheduled, Northey was nominated to be one of three undersecretaries in Sonny Perdue's USDA. But our conversation begins where it should be, on the farm.
I've always wondered how a guy who's a full-time farmer can decide to run for political office and still be a full-time farmer. So how did you get chores done and be here by 8 o'clock this morning?
It can be a challenge, but obviously once I became Secretary of Agriculture, I became a full-time weekend farmer. So it was just running home on weekends, maybe in spring and fall, sneaking in part of a Monday or a Friday. But otherwise, all the week is down here. And one of the problems, my farm is 3.5 hours from Des Moines. So it takes not just a few minutes to get to the farm, but several hours. So you don't go home for an evening. But it was a great experience. I had good help at home. I've got a part-time guy that also works full-time during the week. And we harvest and plant mostly on weekends, certainly often more with tractor lights than we do during the daylight. But we both so enjoy getting out on the farm, and it certainly helped keep me grounded as secretary.
What is your acreage size? How big of a place do you have?
So it's 600 acres, 300 acres of corn, 300 acres of soybeans. I'm up in that area that's square field, so it's actually just two fields of corn and two fields of soybeans on three different farms in total. And so it's pretty easy square fields, very little point rows except along the edge. A very efficient way to be able to do it. Not big equipment, just 12-row equipment and very typical kind of middle-aged equipment. My newest tractor is about 25 years old, but I'm no-till and only put about 100 hours a year on the tractor anyway, so I can't, as long as it keeps running, I can't justify anything newer.
How good are you? Let me see your hands. How greasy are they? Are you good at fixing things?
I can a little. I mean, but I'm certainly not going to do anything major. I need to have a real job so I can pay the mechanic to be able to get it fixed.
You and me both. That's what I never was able to fix anything. Dad was always better at that. So do you think that there are more farmers like you in that 600 acre, my equipment's only 25 years, than there are the ones who I still have the tags from the factory on the machinery?
You know, there's every different type of farmer that you can find out there. There's certainly weekend farmers like myself that are working at a bank in town or for the co-op or something else in town, working at a manufacturing plant. And so many wonderful manufacturing plants across Iowa, and folks will give them a little more time off in the spring and the fall to get things done. There's full-time family farms with six family members and six employees out there farming and that trade their equipment every year. Thank goodness they do, because 25 years later I get a chance at being able to buy something that's depreciated in a way that I can justify it on my operation. So there's just so many different kinds. There's vegetable farmers, there's livestock farmers. That's one of the neat things of being able to do this job and get out a little bit across the state, and you see everybody has their own circumstance. And so government needs to make sure that while you're thinking of one, when you're putting a policy together, you don't end up messing up somebody else that's out there. You think of the regulatory functions or paperwork functions that folks need to fill out, and you remember that a lot of these folks are working 40 hours someplace else, and they're doing this 30 hours a week and doing none of it during times that a government office is open. So how in the world do we be able to make it easy for them to get a question answered if they have a question about what they're going to fill out and get in to be able to talk to somebody and be able to design a conservation practice or learn what's going on at a field day for cover crops or those kinds of things.
Well, do you think it's better, or do you think it's changed, I should say, from when you started? There probably weren't as many hobby farmers as there were when you started, and there are more now. Are we better off with hobby farmers? Do we need more full-time farmers?
You know, I think we need farmers in every situation. We have a lot of young folks that are that's how they get started farming, was farming with mom and dad on weekends and then picking up a quarter or an 80 and now two quarters and three quarters. Dad's getting ready to retire, and when they're 35 years old is when they become their first full-time farmer. So if we didn't have room for those part-time farmers, those second-generation, third-generation, sometimes first-generation farmers, we wouldn't make that next full-time farmer in some cases. So I think we just need to be able to have all different pieces. It needs to be able to work. It's the creativity that there is in the countryside, not only the creativity and how you put a business together, but it's the creativity and how you figure out how to get fertilizer on that crop and how you get a no-till attachment to work on a planter and fertility, and now this whole effort around cover crops. You know, how are we going to seed our cover crops? We've got to fly it on, we got to drill it on, we got to put it on with a spinner spreader on our combine head. What are we going to do new and different? I don't think we want to limit that creativity. We want to encourage it.
Because they're trying to cut down passes on a field because of time.
That's right.
If you can seed it on the back of a combine,
that's
I mean, that's one of those cool, I call it cool, ways to, if you're going to do cover crop, let's just put it on while we're harvesting the old one.
That's right. We've got folks doing it that way. Obviously, folks flying it on, folks with a drill or hiring somebody. We have some folks that are out there putting their cover crops on their last cultivator pass or last sprayer pass, trying to get it to go dormant, but it'll get a head start on fall because it'll go ahead and germinate, get ready to go, and when you pull that crop off, maybe 6 weeks, maybe 8 weeks later, it'll actually be started and rooted and going. So lots of different creative ways, but as you say, everybody's trying to figure out for their own operation. Is it time? Is it dollars? Is it to try and get good feed for a cattle operation? What is it that they're trying to optimize in their kind of version of seeding? And that's just kind of the latest version of it. That's also how folks take care of cattle and run livestock operations and all kinds of things.
How do you, if you're an absentee landowner or maybe the widowed landowner on something and you've got this new guy or gal that's your operation right now and they're apprehensive about cover crops, putting them on, I just don't know how it's going to pencil out. How am I know you think you want me to do this. How do you encourage someone to maybe force the hand of that farmer, or I guess force the hand, that becomes a little political part. I don't want to, I guess that steps over the line there. But how do you strongly encourage to say, I think you really should take a look at putting some radishes on or whatever it is you're going to put on?
You know, I think if you're a landlord, I think one of the best ways to say, hey, is try some on my acres. I'll split some cost with you. It costs some money to do this. Let's find out if there's some cost share. Let's talk to three or four of our neighbors to see what they're doing. Pick our strategy, and maybe it's oats ahead of a corn. If there's risk that we won't get that rye killed and the challenge of starting corn in it, but let's do it together. And let's do it on small acreage to start with. Most of these things, and that's the nice thing about cover crops, is we can do it on 20 acres of a quarter section or of 1,000 acres to try it. And we know that we need to try it in dry year and wet year. And so there's some experience that needs to be gained over time. But partner with your tenant over that and figure out how it's going to work and then adjust.
Okay. Oh, that's a good idea. What if you're in a neighborhood where you're the only one? There isn't anybody to ask. There are certain pockets of the state,
yeah.
And then there might be some people who are pretty closed off to new trends. They don't go to field days. They don't go, and this is the way we've always done it. We have we till this thing three times before we plant it. That no-till is still a bunch of crunchy stuff we don't want anything to do
That's
with.
Right.
There are some apprehensive areas of this state. How do you stick your neck out if there isn't anybody else? And that's because you know how farmers are from fence row. What's he doing over there? They don't want to do it because that's completely different. They're going to get made fun of.
We do pay attention to what's happening across the fence, and folks will, you know, we'll all know when that first person drives a combine out in the field, or certainly the first rye cover crop is used out there. That's pretty hard to hide. I do think there's plenty of opportunities to be able to learn from each other, and there's field days, more and more field days. There's certainly publications. A lot of our publications, ag publications and others, have done a great job in sharing some of the information. You can go out and find a field day to go to that's being mentioned and sit down and say, what'd you do first? What's the place to try? And then often you can find somebody as well that'll help custom application. And that doesn't have to be somebody across the fence. That can be somebody 30 miles away. And the first time we flew on some cover crops, we didn't know who was flying cover crops on in our area or where to get rye seed. And our co-op figured out how to do that. And now they're doing that for some of our neighbors as well. Try it. Most of us try it first on some ground we own or some ground we cash rent, where a landlord isn't very concerned as long as you're paying the cash rent. And then it's our risk. If it doesn't work, then it's our problem. And once we get it figured out in a way that'll work, that we're very confident that we can go to a landlord and say, hey, this is going to work for both of us. Are you willing to have this on your farm as well? And let's split some costs. And this is what it's going to return. This is how it's going to improve the soil organic matter, hold the soil in place, lots of the other good things besides the water quality benefits. So it's still start small, find a way. There's farmers do this all the time. One of the things I hear from folks sometimes is not enough farmers are changing fast enough in this. And you go, if you actually sit back and look on their operation, they're considering herbicide, they're considering seed, they're considering tillage methods and different equipment. They get approached with probably 200 different new things they could do every year. They can, you know, process 10 of those. And so we choose 10 out of that 200. There's 190 folks out there that think we're making a mistake by not choosing their change. And maybe we are, but we can't incorporate all that. And certainly cover crops has to fit into that, just like changing our fertility method, splitting our nitrogen rates, or doing different things differently. We've got to figure that out, and we've got to figure it out for our different fields and our different soil types and our different rotations and our different landlords as well. So lots of things always moving, even though when you drive by the field, it kind of looks like the same, you know, corn and soybeans that were there 30 years ago, but it's not.
You mean farming is that complicated? It's not just to put the combine in and put the planter in and out and we're done?
Isn't that something?
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy to think in a state like Iowa, how much agriculture impacts us and how much is going on inside that field that the average person doesn't know. And as Iowa becomes less rural and more urban, you've almost got a tougher time of telling folks that all of those decisions that you're talking about, of those 200, there's a whole bunch going on right on that other side of that field.
We do have a challenge doing that, and as it gets more complicated, the language gets even deeper and more sophisticated in a way that we have our own code in the way we use acronyms. And there'd be a few folks listening to this going, what the heck is a cover crop? We
right.
just spent 5 minutes already talking about it without describing it. So one of the neat things as I've gotten around and I get to lots of different businesses, ag businesses, but other businesses as well, and schools and other kinds of things, you realize how sophisticated all of life is. There'd be a lot of folks that walk into your studio and go, really, you just don't have a phone and sliding it back and forth and recording this? There's more to it than that. We go into a manufacturing plant and you go, well, wait a minute, you just don't have a hacksaw cutting this? What's this laser, million-dollar laser cutter that you have out here, water-based, and the sophisticated computer systems that drive these benders and cutters and everything else that challenges the steel that you have. Everything is more sophisticated. It means all of us get a little less knowledgeable about the things that go on with the folks that we're sitting alongside at church or standing in line at Walmart with, because their life has progressed and we think we could do anything out there, and we probably could learn to do anything. But we're not ready to do anything, and certainly that's true of farming. There's a lot of sophistication in the decisions that have to be made out there.
That can be said about pretty much anything, how it's much more difficult than we realize. Mm-hmm. Case in point would probably be the North American Free Trade Agreement. We always joke about here, but there was an old West Wing episode a few years ago, and they had a former Secretary of State, and they said, we just needed to give the best 6 to 8 seconds on trade. And he just, I can't do that. You know, trade is incredibly hard. What's good for Iowa is not even the same in Cedar Rapids as it is in Spirit Lake. It's different for each part, let alone each facet of the bill. We had Tom Vilsack on in studio a couple of weeks ago talking about – he was just talking about a small little part of dairy. And it's not small to the dairy producer in the least. It's a major thing. But that's inside of agriculture, which is inside of a larger package when it comes to trade. How, as an ag secretary of the largest corn and soybean producing state, and I know you're going to tell me there's five other things we're number one at as well, how do we say, you know what, trade's been pretty darn good for us?
Yeah, I think we have to keep talking about it. We have to share the numbers. You know, we ship over $1.5 billion worth of pork out of the state of Iowa overseas every year. We produce more corn than all but three countries in the world. We have a great ethanol industry that ships ethanol and DDGs outside the country as well. Without that ability to do that, with just 3 million people, we couldn't consume all that we have. We couldn't pay the bills as well. We need that export income that comes from that trade. So I think we have to, number one, share, because just driving down the gravel roads, you don't necessarily know where it all goes. And you need to be able to know that we absolutely want to keep the bacon and the Iowa chops of that pork, but we're glad to ship off the pig's ears and pig's feet to somebody else that are willing to pay more. But we can't do that if we don't have a trade agreement that allows us to be able to have the ability to be able to do that without duties that are out of line. And that means that it requires a lot of sophistication. It's not just pork. It is all the pork products. It's not just the pork products. It's whether they're cooked or not, or whether they're frozen or not, or whether they're chilled or not, or what chill's description is. Each of those show up on a line on a trade agreement. Way over my head, again, although I can understand that there is sophistication, I haven't been through each of those conversations to know what that takes and why a country is sensitive to one of those and not as sensitive to another one of those discussions. So it is tough. It's a challenge, but it's hugely important. Our manufacturing plants in the state of Iowa, they seem so local. They are. They're huge local impact, but some of them buy products from overseas. Some of them ship products overseas. Some of them do both. And they need trade agreements that work as well.
We don't have the major manufacturing in this state that we did at one time. It is much more the smaller 100 plant, not 1,000 plant. And it seems to be, again, I don't understand it, but it's those 1,000 to 10,000 plant jobs, whether it's the Ford or the Maytag or the whatever it is, these major things that had shipped jobs to Mexico. That's the thing that rings out real well on a campaign trail. But in reality, Waterloo might be stronger now because it doesn't have certain manufacturing that it did in the 80s. They are more diverse. Therefore, they are able to handle more political changes, whether it's left or right, whoever is in the White House. And that's not even a simple way to describe it, but is it as simple? I don't even know what the question is. but it, again, just goes down to even manufacturing isn't as simple as...
That's exactly right.
Your widget is different than my widget.
That's right.
And where I find my labor for my product is different.
That's right. And your labor consists not only of the labor in your shop, which can be a real challenge right now, and we could get into a whole area of the challenge of finding people in Iowa, but it's also the labor that goes into things that you buy from other places, either down the street or farther away than that. It costs the transportation costs there is to get here. We change regulations around trucking regulations in Washington, D.C., and we impact our manufacturing plants here, our livestock production here, lots of other kinds of things too. So the impact of government, the impact outside our communities, on our communities, is huge. I'm sure it's always been that way, but now the sophistication of everything is such that things are specialized, and if something changes, we can't get a cell phone, or we can't get a cell phone part, and that has become something we depend on every day, or another part that goes into something else that's being manufactured, we can be absolutely impacted by something halfway across the world.
All right, you said the W word. You're going to have to learn how to say it and take out the Warsh part. Have you practiced saying Washington, D.C.?
Oh, well, a little bit, yeah.
So
they know what I mean.
Recently, yeah. Before we recorded this interview, I mean, your name had been whispered for several positions in trade magazines that Bill Northey from Iowa is in line for this and this, and finally it comes out over on Friday. You've been nominated. And who knows how long the nomination process takes, but it's an undersecretary job, Undersecretary Perdue. What can you tell me about the position that you have been nominated for?
This is called Farm Production and Conservation, Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation. So responsible for the mission area is Farm Service Agency, so loans, CRP, farm program payments, in addition to other kinds of things, disaster payments, other things, crop insurance, so all the different aspects of crop insurance that are out there, including margin protection for dairy and lots of other products. And then NRCS, the conservation side of USDA as well, the one that pays cost share for terraces and grass waterways, looking at water quality and soil health, lots of partnerships with states, with organizations. So those three mission areas, kind of as Secretary Perdue will talk about it, it's kind of the customer-facing portion of USDA, the folks that farmers deal with often. Over 20,000 people in those mission areas together. A couple of those areas, like NRCS and FSA, it'd be the first time they're under the same undersecretary. They've been under separate undersecretaries before. That's worked, but it's created challenges, and the vision here is to be able to make sure that they're working in tandem so that one side doesn't ask a farmer to do one thing and the other side asks the farmer to do something else, that they actually are accepting the same information from the farmer and that they're keeping up with the technology that farmers have in planting equipment and reporting equipment and other kinds of things. And so plenty of challenges, most of which I'm not even aware of yet. I certainly will understand all those challenges if and when I get there.
And these, I believe, are they three undersecretaries that they're trying to form, or is it more than
this
three?
This is three administrative areas,
yeah,
under one,
right,
undersecretary. I'd be the undersecretary, and those three program areas would be under my mission area. So
and,
that would,
and
be
and
my,
would each of them have
they'd
a
each
head.
Have administrators,
and
yes,
then like chief. You, there'd be two mm-hmm. other people like you under Secretary Perdue. Is that
no?
The pillars?
I would. Yeah, I'd be no. There's six. There's
okay.
Seven total undersecretaries. I'd be responsible for these areas: FSA,
sure,
RMA, and NRCS. And then there's others that look at APHIS, which is Animal Plant Health and Inspection,
right,
Service, or trade, or other areas.
So those, and are these new positions, new ways of shuffling the way these cards have been dealt out
it
before?
It is. They have all been there, but they've been under separate places. So typically Foreign Ag Service was with FSA, and now it is separate in its own area, but NRCS is with FSA.
Okay. The fiscal conservative will tell me that if there's 300 political positions open right now and we've been functioning for 6 months, without them filled. Why do we need to fill these positions?
Well, we may find out a little bit longer yet. It takes a while, even from this point forward. But I think it does impact the decision-making ability for folks moving forward. So some of the policies, we have a farm bill coming up, and the ability to be able to address the political dynamics or make recommendations on a farm bill really is the political side as opposed to the civil service side of USGA. So we absolutely have great people. We have disaster programs. We've had drought declared in the western states in Iowa. CRP has been opened up for hay. Those mechanics continue to happen, and they're doing a great job. But the ability to adjust a crop insurance program for a new crop or to be able to look at a new conservation program by pulling in partners really takes the kind of the political leadership alongside Secretary Perdue to be able to bring those kinds of ideas forward. So there will be a value there. We'll see. We'll try and create as much value as we can, I guess.
You talk about crop insurance. It's one thing we discuss in our row here. And we read things and say, you know, crop insurance makes a lot of sense because it's not a broad approach. It can be tailored to what your operation mm-hmm. is. Do you think the political strength is there to maybe move more into crop insurance than a blanket program? Because as we said, your situation as a 600-acre farmer from northwest Iowa is different than the 10,000-acre farmer in northeast Iowa.
Yeah, the situation has adjusted, or crop insurance can be very specialized to the kind of situation a person's in. You can choose what your level of coverage is, but I'm sure I'm going to get a better understanding for the regional differences, the crop differences. There's folks in other parts of the country that can articulate why they think crop insurance is not working as well as it should in their region for their crop. For most of the Midwestern producers, crop insurance is that safety net we look forward to. And this is a perfect example of it. So we have parts of Iowa that are going to have their best crop they've ever had, equal to or better than last year. We have parts in Iowa that are going to have less than 40 bushel average corn yield on their farm. And the nice thing is it didn't take an ad hoc disaster program trying to figure out how in the world we sort through that. We have farmers that have average yields for their last 10 years. That's what they guaranteed. They bought coverage based on how much risk they could handle. And those that have a big crop are very happy not to get crop insurance this year. Those that have a very small crop are saying, if I didn't have it, I might not be farming next year. So crop insurance can respond in a way that works for that individual farm, not even just across the state, but sometimes across the fence from each other. If the river comes out or you got a sand pocket on your farm versus somebody else. So, but there are places and crops that will say that's not sufficient. We need our ARC. We need our PLC. And I've got a lot to learn and a lot to hear about all that.
Yeah. I mean, it just becomes the southern interest now. Cotton is different. Sorghum is different. Wheat is different, not crops that are grown in abundance in Iowa. And so now the intricacies of those become That's filled right. into your brain. What do you think goes out? Where the best tenderloin in Iowa is? Do you think that gets pushed out to make room for the other?
No, I don't think that's valuable information. I don't think part of that still is always under adjustment. You've got to keep testing. You've got to be able to keep finding new tenderloin opportunities. So that needs to stay.
Are you a breaded or unbreaded person?
I'm more of a breaded person, yes.
And does the bun need to fit the size, or does it need to be dwarfed by the size of the tenderloin?
You know, both. The tenderloin needs to be juicy, and I've seen both the large tenderloins the bun is only a quarter of the tenderloin, as well as those that the bun actually covers up the tenderloin. Either one can be very good, but it shouldn't be overdone and shouldn't be dry.
Do you think that you will find in traveling the country that there are places that don't have tenderloin? And maybe part of your mission with USDA could be to spread the love of the Tenderloin to other regions of this country.
You know, that could well be, and that would be a valuable mission to deliver on if I could deliver on that. I am told by my friends in Indiana that they are very, very proud of their Tenderloins in Indiana, and that other than Iowa and Indiana, now I, you know, others will be able to correct me on this, but that the Tenderloin choices are pretty thin outside these areas. This is a regional food that we specialize in, or at least our folks that have figured out how to do this. So there could well be an opportunity to spread the good word of Tenderloins. I'm not sure whether we'll be able to create the expertise in other places. We'll just have to have them come to Iowa, maybe Indiana as well, to be able to learn how good it is.
All right, so you have to go. Your phone next to us has been going off a lot. And the only reason I bring that up is your job never really stops, does it? I mean, because I follow you on a few social media channels, and you're everywhere all the time. How on earth do you ever do that as a statewide official? I mean, even in Iowa, it's a fairly small state.
Yeah, just I think all of us want to be in a job that we love. I can tell you love your job. When we're out someplace, both away from our work, you're trying to figure out what's going on and what's next, and you want to learn. And somebody who loves baseball is always talking baseball, whether they're on the field
or
not.
I apologize for that. Yes,
and I am. I just love what I do. I'd love to be able to get out, and so it may not be my working hours, but if I can be out there and see something new, talk to somebody, learn something, be able to match them up with somebody else who's doing something interesting as well, put them together so that they can share information, both be better, I love to be able to do it. So it'd be miserable if I didn't love it, because it is a lot of hours, but it's what I love to do. So I can think of nothing I'd rather be doing during those quote-unquote off hours as well, is learning about agriculture, finding out what's going on, hearing neat things, sharing some of those with other people as well.
You have the ability to go to county fairs, state fairs, regional fairs, town celebrations. So which ones are better, town celebrations or county fairs?
Oh, man, you're not going to make me choose on that.
You said on July 15th.
That's right. I love county fairs. And one neat thing is they're all so different. But I'll tell you, the similarities between the two is they're all run by volunteers. They're all run by people that are passionate. They're all run by people not doing their regular job. They're out there doing it. And I was talking to somebody at a parade the other day on a town celebration, and said, "How long have you been doing this?" "Well, I've been working with this parade for 25 years. You know, why are you doing this?" "Well, you know, I just love the people, and I love to be able to do it. And when it comes off, it's just the most satisfying thing. And we'll start working on the plans for next year right away. We'll get together next week." And that's what I hear in county fairs. I talked to somebody in Northeast Iowa at a county fair, and they said, "I tell you, My insurance agent's the easiest one to get support for, financial supports for." And I said, "Why is that?" He said, "He lives across the street from the fair." And when I go up to him, he said, "Well, you guys have been there all the time working on the fair, you know, repainting buildings and rewiring buildings. Absolutely. If I don't have to come out there and work with you, I'll give you some money." Because people realize how much love people put into their celebration, into their community, whether that's a fair or whatever kind of activity. It's a tractor ride. There are just so many different things. It's their FFA group. We got 4-H volunteers that have been a 4-H leader for 30 years in Iowa. We just have a great crew of folks, and I think the whole world does, but I think we have more than our share.
The state fair model for that insurance agent who's across the street from the county fair. Maybe do you think they sell for parking across over there?
They probably do.
They could make money both
ways.
That's
maybe what he's doing. It's just giving him money
exactly, that
he made at the fair.
Takes one.
Selling parking. That's right.
I see you a lot at the state fair. You are a busy guy. You might even be busier than the governor always is. When you think of state fairs, now you're going to probably head to a few more of them. I mean, you've been to how many other state fairs have you been to?
You know, I have not been to very many, maybe a couple others, and that's it. And those were a long, long time ago. And my intention would have always been to get around, see some of the other fairs. I know the fair board does a good job of being able to get out to other fairs, but life gets crazy, and I don't get to very many. I will get a chance probably to be able to get to some of those fairs and those events, those ag events, because that's where, you know, our constituents will be. That's where we want to have some farm bill hearings and other kinds of things. And way ahead of myself, I got confirmation hearings and other things to go through, and a lot of other folks that need to share what the plans are. But I look forward to being able to see how the ag community gathers around the country in their own version of what we do here in Iowa.
Because you still, I suppose if you do vacate your position, that means you probably won't, because you're on the Iowa State Fair Board now,
right?
And that's for the sitting Secretary of Agriculture.
Correct.
Gary Slater's going to probably have to figure a way to have a conversation with you of keeping you on that fair board somehow.
Well, the next secretary will be on that fair board, and so that's the way it needs to be. I'll be able to still come back and enjoy the fair and appreciate it, and miss not being there all the time. There's a lot of things I'll miss about not being Iowa Secretary of Ag if the confirmation all happens.
Goes that way. Yeah, I know. I keep putting you ahead of that. How many days do you make it this year's State Fair, 2017? How many did you make?
I made 11 or 10 of the 11 days.
10 of the 11 days. Yeah. And do you normally have something every single day or five things in one day that you need to do?
Yeah, pretty much. And some of those are by design, by necessity, and some of them are things that we create. So I usually get a chance to be able to hand out eggs on a stick and work the pork tent, as well as our big day is Century Farm and Heritage Farm Day. We gave out 354 Century Farm Awards this year, 119 Heritage Farm Awards, which is when a family owns the farm for 150 years. So we started about 9 o'clock that Thursday and went to about 7 p.m. that day, handing out certificates and getting pictures with families. And you're definitely ready to sit down at the end of the day, but it is a wonderful day. It is just America. To be able to come back and that's one of the days I want to be able to come back to Iowa State Fair and be able to sit and watch that, because that's a gathering of folks that are celebrating the heritage of their farm, the people who started that farm, and then the hope and the promise that future generations may well own that farm as well. And very emotional. Most of the time, folks in agriculture, pretty stoic. We're not very emotional. That day probably gets a little more emotional than most days, and it's a neat thing to be a part of. So lots of activities at the fair, and the fair is full of them, from, rabbit judging to folks that are there just because they are showing their sheep. And never – I talked to some folks that said, I never get north of the sheep barn at the fair,
So that's a very southern part of the fair.
That's exactly right.
Are there areas that are that you eat different than another? Do you have to give me a political answer of I have to get to these six stands? Are there ones that stand out?
The nice thing about going for 10 days is there's a lot of meals involved. But we often as well have fair board meetings and association with some meals together. So that kind of eats into the available appetite. But always pork chop on a stick, and usually take a box home at the end of the fair. Always a turkey drumstick and certainly hot beef sundae. And so we've got friends that run the solid nut roll stand. And there's too many to start listing here. And then there's always some new ones too, right, Paul?
You got to try the new ones.
Got to try the new ones. Yeah, you got to try the new ones and decide whether they're a new favorite or not. Flash in the pan, not going to make it.
I did try the pork explosion. Is that the one that was the one there by the grandstand? We did try that one day. That was a lot of food.
Yeah.
And I did not – somebody was just telling me Saturday. They're like, did you try the turkey – basically the Thanksgiving meal all in one bite?
Thanksgiving balls. I did. Absolutely. Helped at the turkey stand and enjoyed those.
Yeah.
Very good. Very good.
So, okay. Yeah. All right. Well, I appreciate all your time and appreciate what you've done for Iowa. And
thank you, Paul.
And I'm sure that the confirmation hearings, the preparation will be I won't call it fun, but I guess you'll have something to do while you're listening in the car. They might be, they might put some stuff on audio for you
That's
to listen
right.
to.
That's
and,
right.
And you have to remember, I said that? I don't remember saying that.
That's right.
All right, Bill Northey, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Paul.
The MTM is a production of Iowa Public Television and can be found wherever you download podcasts. I'm Paul Yeager. Thanks for listening.